Hey, it's John, and you've probably heard me talk about True Diagnostics' True Age Test. My results were a game changer, but have you tried it? Here's why I think you should. Many of the health risks that accompany aging are in your control. The True Age Test didn't just give me a number, it showed me how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging. It was eye-opening. The test will give you tailored tips from Ivy League scientists, like tweaking diet and sleep, to slow aging and cut risks. As a result, I started taking more vitamin C and a mushroom supplement that seems to be helping me with focus and overall health. It was so easy, a quick at-home finger prick, send it off, and in 2 to 3 weeks, I got a detailed report. No doctor, no hassle. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code, Harris, to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use HARRIS at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. We are now live on the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. Hope everyone is doing well this weekend. I don't usually podcast on a Saturday, but this is the time I have. So this is when we're doing it. So I know some of you will be listening probably after the weekend, but we have a lot of things to obviously discuss from this week. And for those who are interested in Christian news, specifically Southern Baptist news, I do have a number of things to share with you today that I don't think have been shared on any other platform. So that should be good. And you can pray for me and for my church. You know, this is kind of a big, last 2 weeks really have been a big 2 weeks for evangelism. We had a VBS, which I wasn't really involved with, but there were a lot of people at my church who were. We had a lot of kids. And then this week, we do an evangelism ministry at the county fair. I was there last night. I'll be there again tonight, possibly tomorrow if I can swing it. We'll see. But I'm just reminded about how we do talk about these things related to evangelical news, which I think are very important. We want a strong, thriving church, and there are so many inhibitors to that, right? I think it's a little bit like the toil that goes into farming. Or, you know, think of some kind of blue collar, sweaty work that you would do outside. I mean, it's hard. That is kind of like how ministry is. And there are a lot of people who want to take shortcuts and false teachers and all kinds of threats that threaten the flock. And I think there's a reason God says that he makes the comparison that Christians are like sheep. And they need shepherds, right? We need good shepherds. We need virtuous men in leadership positions. And so we talk about that a lot, but I'm so reminded that yes, they're sheep, but there's also people outside the fold, right? There's people who are not sheep or have not become sheep yet. And that's the ministry as well. And so it's, you know, there's more than enough work to do out there. There's more than enough things to pray for out there. There's more than enough things to labor toward and do ministry. And if you don't know your spiritual gifts, figure that out and then use them in the context of a local church. Get yourself plugged in. That's my encouragement here as we start the podcast, because I just see a lot of effort going into sometimes things that I wonder, is this really where effort should go into, right? Not everyone can be a podcaster. Obviously, we're doing a podcast here. I think podcasts can be great, but it's not for everyone. Not everyone's going to be in the limelight. Not everyone's going to be doing a Twitter or Facebook or Instagram kind of ministry. We need people in those places, but I think of 1 Corinthians chapter 12, when Paul talks about the showy gifts, right? Not everyone's going to be in the showy gifts. Some people are, some people aren't. I don't even know if I consider those things necessarily gifts for a local church. I mean, I guess parachurch. I don't know. How would you consider that? But we actually have a full range of things that God has gifted us in that need to be done. And we're only complete when we function in the ways God has specifically ordained and gifted us. And that only comes through stepping out in faith and using gifts. And testing to see whether you have the gifts that you think you might have, seeing if it blesses other people, seeing if there's fruit from it, right? And being walking with the Lord on a close level, day to day, in the Word, praying, trying to ascertain what is the direction that the Holy Spirit wants for me today. That's what it's all about, guys. And so Anyway, I wasn't planning on saying that, but that's how we're going to open the podcast today. And tomorrow's the Lord's Day. So anything of that I just said landed, you can go talk to your pastor. If you don't have a pastor, find a solid Bible-believing church in your community. All right, yeah, we're going to talk about Leatherwood, Brent Leatherwood today from the ERLC a little bit. We're going to talk about a number of things today, but we already have some comments coming in. Conceptual clarity. Man, conceptual clarity, you are such a faithful listener. If one simply says our community is founded by and for conservative Christians or traditional Americans, I think this is in relation to a topic we will get to about a community that was, I guess it's still around. That I don't think it's even a community yet. It's in a dream of what a community could be for a whites only community, I believe. And it was at Arkansas. We'll get to the story, but conceptual clarity is saying, well, what about if it's just a Christians only kind of thing, right? You're probably asking for all kinds of legal trouble. And if you don't dot your I's and cross your T's in our current environment, and you try to do something like that. But I would challenge you I'm going to go down the rabbit hole here in just a minute. As Christians, we're salt and light in the world, right? We're in the world. We're not of the world. We're in the world. I'm not a big fan of a Christians only community, that idea. I don't like that. Because I think we're supposed to make an impact on the world around us. And yes, I do know of places around us, around where I live, that think of some Anabaptist groups that essentially have commune type structures. So that's maybe not exactly what conceptual clarity is talking about, but it definitely shields you from the world. But the problem is the sin is in the human heart. And when you have children, it's not a guarantee all of them are going to be Christians. And especially if you give them formulas and you try to shield that, they're going to be more curious about what's out there. I think it's better you raise your children to have discernment, teach them at appropriate ages what to look for and what to be aware of, the potential evil and the temptations that are out there, and strengthen them so that they can meet those temptations. I think that's the Christian way. That's the way Christians have done it. And to sequester yourself off oftentimes has bad consequences. And it also inhibits you from your mission. It's hard to reach people in the world. And you also get weird. And I know that's not a biblical category, maybe. That's about my thing. Like, you also get weird the more you segment yourself off. So, but I get it. If you live in like the Northeast or the Pacific Northwest, especially, it's like, man, the culture around me doesn't support the values that I believe. And wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice? Just get back to nature and have a community of people that are just like me. Rarely works out that way. I think there's some prudential ways to approach that question, and there's some very unwise ways. And we're going to be talking about that later in the podcast. So let's see, there's more comments coming in, but I got to get to the stuff here. So I didn't even have it pulled up. So we're going to pull it up right now. I need to mention to you real quick, three things actually, before we get started with all the info. So Politico did a story on the term, the Heritage America. And I was interviewed for the story, and I'm going to just be honest with you. Politico didn't do a bad job. Politico did not do a bad job, which is a little surprising because I would expect Politico to do a bad job, and they didn't. I would expect a more leftist tilted news source to not handle this issue well. And Politico surprised me pleasantly. So I'll just get to the portion, if I can find it, where I'm quoted. It's like one paragraph. I had like a 40-minute conversation, something like that, with the reporter. But then it's like a documentary film. Only a little bit of it. I'm going to have to search for my name here. Only a little bit gets put in. So, that wasn't what I wanted. Let's try this. Okay. So it says, there it is. Heritage America just isn't a demographic category, though. It's also, for lack of a better word, a vibe. As the conservative writer and documentarian John Harris, who has written about Heritage America, the Heritage America debate, put it, online, a loose aesthetic has developed around the term, cultivated via memes and viral posts. The aesthetic draws heavily on the nostalgic symbolism of the colonial period and the 19th century frontier, supplemented by a hefty dose of gauzy Americana. Images of Daniel Boone and his
coonskin capped pioneers abound alongside Norman Rockwell paintings of the mid-20th century American life. "It's the knight, the cavalier, and then the cowboy," said Harris, who claims direct ancestry from Daniel Boone's father, Squire Boone. "It's about what it looks like to be a gallant and to have these virtuous characteristics that we associate with the leaders of our civilization." So that is the Heritage America article there. And the other thing I wanted to just show you real quick is this. So I don't know if I did this on the podcast yet. I feel like I did, but I don't remember. But if I'll just repeat myself. So the Fight, Laugh, Feast magazine, if some of you might get this, I'm impressed. I've been subscribed, but I was looking at the magazine and it has recipes as barbecue recipes. It was like sort of tilted towards guys, I think. And it's got actual sheet music for this psalm you can sing. And it's just very professionally done. And this is not, they didn't pay me to say this. I'm just telling you, it's good quality paper. I'm impressed. And there's a number of articles from different perspectives, all Christian Orthodox people, from what I understand, but they're perspectives on natural law and theonomy. And so I wrote one of the articles for this on natural law and theonomy, and you can go check that out. If you are a patron and you're in our signal group on Patreon, you of course have already had access to this. I actually just posted on Patreon itself a link for those who want to read this, but I can't publish this anywhere for 6 months. So you're on your honor. Don't put this anywhere else, right? This is just an essay that if you are a supporter on Patreon, you can read. But hopefully after 6 months, I'll be getting it out there via TruthScript or some other organization. So there you go. All right. And the one last thing I wanted to mention before we get into the news of the day is this speaking, some of the speaking engagements I have coming up. So we'll start here in August. So at the end of this month, the 28th through the 30th, I will be at the World Right in Front of You Conference in Batavia, Ohio. And you can go to my website, John Harris Media, and go to speaking if you want to find out more. Just click the link there. But it's hosted by East River Church, and we have a number of good folks speaking. William Wolfe is going to be there. Michael Foster is going to be there. Ryan Denton, Keith Foskey, Jake Menzel. So check it out. I would love for you, if you are in that area, if you're in Ohio, just come on out. And would love to see you. And then, of course, the men's retreat, music and masculinity is the theme in Speculator New York that we do every year, September 25th through the 28th. It'll be beautiful. That's a great weekend in the Adirondacks because it depends on the rainfall and the temperature. But usually you have color by that time. There's really no question you will have color. But oftentimes that is the peak in the Adirondacks. So it's the best time to see the fall colors. And the people who have come out to the men's retreat absolutely love that aspect of it, getting into nature, being with friends, making new relationships. And so I'm looking forward to that, and I hope you are too, and we'll see you there. All right, well, let's get into some of the stuff today, because there's a lot of stuff, and we're going to start with the ERLC, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission for the Southern Baptist Convention, the ERLC. And I want to start off here. I wrote an article for The Federalist a while back, and the end of the article, I talk a little bit about Brent Leatherwood on the subject of immigration, right? So I say that in 2019, denominational leaders in the SBC, including Brent Leatherwood and Dean and Sarah, signed an evangelical call for restitution-based immigration reform, and this was published by the Evangelical Immigration Table. The statement portrayed deportation as unjust, insinuated the United States government was to blame for separating families, and supported a restitution-based pathway to legal permanent residency for illegal migrants, right? This is the thing we have been fighting forever. This category people want to give us that includes illegal migrants who have come here, but doesn't want to give them full citizenship. It's like this halfway measure, but these halfway measures often end up being a path to amnesty. And they'll always say, well, we're not for amnesty, right? Well, like, I understand that, but it's a stepping stone, and we can recognize that. For the next 4 years, though, during the Joe Biden presidency, the SBC took hardly any action on immigration issues, despite the fact that illegal migrants poured across the border at record numbers. Then suddenly, Brent Leatherwood and the ERLC took a strong stand in February 2024 to support Senator Lankford's Emergency National Security Supplemental Appropriations Act, which prohibited Homeland Security from continuing to exercise emergency authority to respond to the border crisis if the weekly crossings were under 21,000 encounters per week. So, you know, as long as it's 21,000 encounters per week or less, hey, things are okay. Since Trump became president again, the ERLC signed on to the Evangelical Immigration Table's letter urging Trump to reinstate sensitive locations policies that would prohibit ICE from entering churches. Leather would also sign on to World Relief Statement to sustain the U.S. refugee resettlement program. So there you go. That's on just one issue. That's immigration. But Brent Leatherwood has not just been bad on immigration policy. He's been bad on gun rights. He was calling for red flag laws. He denied they were red flag laws, but they were in Tennessee. He was the one that was very upfront about suppressing the trans shooter manifesto. He has been bad on the abortion issue from the standpoint that he has been part. He has given his influence and the ERLC's influence to briefs to influence lawmakers towards denying bills that would actually abolish abortion. And it's crazy to me that you have someone like this, to be quite honest with you, at the ERLC. But it's not crazy when you understand the history. And Russell Moore, you know, was his predecessor, and Brent Leatherwood was his protege. Now, Brent Leatherwood has stepped down. He's gone. And so this creates an opportunity. And I kind of joked on X. I think I fooled some people. I wasn't trying to fool anyone, but I just joked that William Wolf would make a great next president of the ERLC. Ha, ha, ha. Right. Like, that'll happen. The guy who's the acting director now, this is a question, the acting president, I guess you could say, I think he's been the vice president. You know, it's possible maybe he'll be the next guy, but here's the thing that I want you to see. If he's the next guy, we just get a continuation. Southern Baptists just get a continuation of what has been. So I'm going to give you a sample of a number of things. And it took me probably 10 minutes, 15 minutes just on his X account to find all this. Here's a article from 2015 by Miles Mullen. He is the acting president right now of the ERLC. Evangelicals and the immigration 1940s style starts off with the Statue of Liberty's "Give me your poor, you're tired, you're poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free," right? All of that. And he goes through kind of this Ellis Island vibe and talks about it in really positive terms, right? And then he says, 3 years after VE Day, the United States passed the Displaced Persons Act of 1948, temporarily expanding immigration in order to welcome people displaced due to World War II. Barely 4 years old at the time, the NAE, the National Association of Evangelicals, unhesitatingly agreed to the State Department's request that it sponsor 3,000 such displaced persons. Leaders hustled into action, raising money. So this is the whole point, right? He's saying this in 2015. And then he ends the article by saying, in our current context, let us at least, it's in italics, demonstrate the same attitude as our compassionate evangelical forebears. So what he's trying to do is saying, look, you had this context after World War II. You had this context during the Ellis Island time. And let's just parallel that with 2015. It's kind of the same thing. We just need to do what they did. And I would argue, actually, we probably don't. Not just for circumstantial reasons, but which I think are enough to say these are different circumstances. But also, I think from the standpoint that I don't necessarily think the National Association of Evangelicals spoke for everyone. That's a Christian in the United States that's a conservative or an evangelical. I also don't know that even if they did, whether that was the right thing at the time. And at the time, it might have looked good, but the question is years later, and the numbers again, you know, are we talking only 3,000 people, right? Is that all we're talking? Because that's also, again, circumstantially, it's a very different number than when we're talking about millions and millions. You know, 30 million is very different than 3,000. So this is the kind of thing that you can expect from a Miles Mullen, and it's very consistent with the ERLC. Here's some Twitter stuff. Miles Mullen, because and he's answering a question. This is actually a very revealing thread, and I don't think I'm going to read the whole thing just for the sake of time. But he's talking about sort of like, I guess, 20th century evangelical history. Okay. and why evangelicals identify politically the way they do and that kind of thing. And he thinks they got duped into, I'm summarizing here, but he thinks they basically got included in a broader coalition that's, they should have never been included in. They got kind of whipped into this conservative political energy. And, you know, that's not really who they are. And so this guy who's interacting with him named Heath Carter, and this is 2019, this happened. He goes, why are they, meaning these evangelicals, so overwhelmingly white then, these conservative political evangelicals, when so many Black believers held those same beliefs? So he's saying, look, if you have similar theologies and so forth, then you like explain this to me, right? And that's a good question. And Miles Mullen goes, well, because while whites had the luxury of making religious identity their primary identity, African-Americans had a race hoisted on them as their primary identity by others, which is kind of interesting because earlier in the thread, he's saying that they were, I probably shouldn't have said duped, but they were definitely included in something that they shouldn't have been included in, or, you know, it wasn't really part of who they were, this conservative coalition, if you will, in the Republican Party. So then this guy, Heath Carter, goes, yeah, we'll have to agree to disagree. White evangelicals fought to preserve systems that privileged whiteness and punished Blackness. Their own racial commitments were not incidental. So Miles Mullen goes, I'm not sure I disagree with that. Okay. All right. Well, so you got Mr. CRT guy, right? You got Mr. CRT analysis guy that's still right now heading up the ERLC. Has anything actually changed? I mean, that was 2019. Maybe he's changed his mind, but there's no public record indicating this. Here's what he said in 2021 when Russell Moore left the ERLC. Godspeed, may you flourish in this new role. Now, I understand this is just a nice thing you say publicly to some, but Russell Moore is just not someone. Russell Moore is someone who slammed the door leaving the Southern Baptist Convention and slammed the convention itself and made accusations against Mike Stone, which have been challenged, which do not seem accurate. And this is Miles Mullen's, I would suggest, I mean, he could have been quiet on this, right? But I would suggest that that might mean that there is an this might indicate that he kind of appreciates Russell Moore. And I don't think a self-respecting SBC guy at that point should be appreciating Russell Moore. Also during 2020, one of my students was George Floyd's pastor in Houston. He speaks here about Floyd and what his death means. Well worth a listen. And the name of the article is Houston Pastor Remembers George Floyd as a Protective, Hospitable, Gentle Giant. I don't know if you remember that. I remember that from that time. I didn't even know this guy had been a student in a Southern Baptist seminary or something like that, but which I'm assuming he was. I remember the article. And gushing about George Floyd and how unjust this whole situation was and all that. Okay, Miles Mullen, right? On the wrong side of a number of issues. Here, what is this? Dr. Moore, okay. Russell Moore, the word evangelical no longer has any meaning. Just call me a gospel Christian. Right, a gospel Christian. It's actually one of the most, I didn't even know Russell Moore said that. You know the word evangelical, that's basically what it means. Okay. So Kevin Smith, the woke ERLC member, goes, Dr. Moore, another edition of our Southern Baptist evangelicals. And Miles Smith goes Miles Mullen, sorry, says to both of them, it has historical meaning wherein there is theological content, but white evangelical GOP alliance has undermined it. Right. That's the problem, guys. That's the problem with the whole evangelical thing. It's these white people. It's these conservative white people. They've ruined the brand. Right. Rather than just, you know, maybe people that have these convictions theologically, maybe they tend to align. Maybe there's cultural things also that go into this, but maybe they tend to align under conservative politics more. Maybe it has something to do with their theology. Could that be the clue? Could that be an issue? No, probably not. And then you have Walter Strickland, right, who's this is kind of earlier. This is 2014. Now, at the time, I guess you could argue that Miles Mullen, maybe he didn't know that Walter Strickland was on board with liberation theology, because this is back in 2014. But he's very, you know, he says that Walter Strickland is a wise voice, so a wise choice, sorry, by Russell Moore in the ERLC. he's serving on the ERLC as a research fellow. I mean, I find that hard to believe because, you know, Walter Strickland, this has been his thing for a long time. So, but okay, let's give him that one. Benefit of the doubt. Miles Mullen, the moral burden of history requires a more direct, he's quoting from here, candid acknowledgement of the legacy of this school, meaning Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and the horrifying realities of American slavery, Jim Crow segregation, racism, and even the avowal of white racial supremacy. This is from 2018. You might remember the task force at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary that was discovering and or trying to rediscover all these things that were connected to what they considered to be racially oppressive things from the past, right? And this is where Al Mohler at that time, Al Mohler was trying to kind of walk a very fine line of saying, condemning the school, right? And acting like the specter is still haunting the Southern Baptist school. This is while they're doing the critical race theory panels on campus. This is the time when people want to get rid of the names of previous influential figures that have their names on buildings on the campus, right? And Al Mohler is trying to say, well, let's not get rid of the names, but you know, let's be real with our history here. And if I remember correctly, this was also the time that you had Al Mohler saying we're going to have like this special scholarship for Black people, essentially. So here's Miles Mullen, and he's trumpeting this this task force. Miles Mullen always, this is him. Oh man, why did I include this? Oh, I guess, I don't know. This is kind of a minor one, but he just talks about the de facto segregation and racism of areas was harder to dislodge than the ugly de jure ones in the South. So, what he's saying is like, because he follows it up more like soft de jure in many Northern and Midwestern places. So he's saying that when people just naturally kind of filter into groups, as people often do, like that's harder to root out. That's a problem, right? Then you have Miles Mullen saying an open letter from the Christian Scholars on Racism in America today. And it's from the Gospel 2017. He responds to Jamar Tisby. Let's see. We have hard stops on racism, end of the Civil War. But when legalized chattel slavery ended, racism didn't. Miles Mullen says, as bad as it was, chattel slavery was a severe symptom of the much deeper problem of racism. And then Miles Mullen, oh, I already had this one. So there's so much more, but it took me like 10, 15 minutes to just grab these. And I think that's just enough for people to realize, okay, like Miles Mullen's the guy who is in charge essentially right now of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission is probably going to be no different than a Brent Leatherwood, than a Russell Moore. Don't expect if he becomes the next president that it's going to change anything. The likely scenario, because people have wanted to know, what's your opinion, John? I don't have any inside track here, okay? I don't think anyone really knows exactly what's going to happen, at least no one from my side of the fence on this particular topic of social justice. It will likely be someone else who's similar to Brent Leatherwood and Russell Moore. Unless, I mean, it's just kind of how it works. Now, I would be pleasantly surprised if that wasn't the case. I don't think you're getting William Wolfe in there, though. I don't think you're going to get someone who's truly the best you can hope for is someone who doesn't want to upset the apple cart in any direction. And so will remain somewhat neutral. But then you wonder, why do you have an Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission if it's not to aggressively pursue issues that Southern Baptists care about and to do so in an effective way, which I would argue Brent Leatherwood's not even, he hasn't even been effective, then what's the point of even having it? You should just disband the whole thing. There's no point. So I am not optimistic about the future of the ERLC, as you can see. And this is playing into it to some extent, who the acting president is at this point. Matthew Barrett. Some people have wanted me to comment on this Matthew Barrett thing. And I don't have much to say, to be honest. I wasn't even going to cover it because I'm like, what? But I don't know. I've had so many people. It's been one of the top things people have said. Are you going to say anything about Matthew Barrett? So just to catch people up who don't know about this, Matthew Barrett is a was a Southern Baptist professor at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City. And when I first heard his name, I was like, I think I know that name. And sure enough, I talked about him once on the podcast, probably 2 years ago. And it was a very passing comment. I don't even know if I talked about him. I think I would play the clip where someone else talked about him. It was a passing comment. And it seemed to indicate he was supportive of some of the Me Too stuff going on in the SBC. I haven't looked into him beyond that. But I know others have said, and maybe they've done digging, that, yeah, he was kind of more on the leftist, I don't know, or, you know, the kind of like Miles Mullen, like he was with those guys. So I don't know. But the issue here is that he converted to Anglicanism and he became a research professor of theology at Trinity Anglican Seminary in Ambridge, Pennsylvania. And this happened kind of immediately. This just happened. Like, it, you know, I'm a Southern Baptist professor and the next I'm an Anglican professor. And this is, I think that's the, I don't even know if I need to say anything else. Maybe we'll go through what his reasons, but to me, that is incredibly foolish. The Bible warns in, especially throughout Proverbs, but in many places, I mean, James, right? Be quick to hear, slow to speak, be cautious. When you take on a new position, and these are very new positions, you need to be careful. You know, another passage, Proverbs 19:2 says, desire without knowledge is not good. How much more will hasty feet miss the way? This is hasty feet. That's my thing on this. This is hasty feet. Now you might say, oh, no, he's been going this direction for a long time or whatever. Well, if that's true, why is he teaching at a Southern Baptist school? Why? And if they, see, you got two options. They either know about it at the school and they're fine with someone who does not share their convictions teaching there. That's a problem. Or he knew about it, but didn't tell anyone. That's a problem. And it, I don't like, look, I could name other names here that people who have abrupt changes it makes me kind of queasy. You know, Jared Longshore is another one. I don't care. I'll say the name. Jared Longshore is another one. I'm at school every week. He's at Founders and they started this Founders. I think at the time it was an institute. It wasn't the seminary, but you know, it was like mid semester or something. Like he just all of a sudden, hey, I'm convinced of paedo baptism and whoa, I got a place to go now that's going to receive me that has these convictions and I can pastor there. I don't like that, guys. When you do a monumental shift like this, because these are big shifts. It's not even just baptism when it comes to this issue, right? This is this concerns baptism. This also concerns polity. Those are, I would say those are probably the two primary things. You you've been a professor at a seminary. This isn't a layman making a move. This is someone you're teaching theology. You're teaching students one theology one day and another theology the next. It's probably best to just slow down, take a breather, you know, don't become the cheerleader for the new theology you just found, the new ideas you just came to. Get a sure footing first. Then proceed and proceed with the wisdom of others. Proceed. I think it's foolish for any institution to receive someone like this too. So I'm not saying that he didn't have conviction. I'm not, you know, we'll go through some of his reasons. Some of them I'm like, what? But yeah, conviction and all this, that's the issue I have with all of this. Right. And I'm very appreciative of Anglicanism. I'm very appreciative of many different Protestant traditions. So I don't have like any ill will with someone going this direction. I mean, you know, some of my best friends are Anglican, right? Some of my best friends are Presbyterian. They really are. I just want men of virtue. And I just don't see it as a virtuous thing to hide a belief or to, for an institution to just kind of rubber stamp someone who doesn't share their convictions. That's kind of a big deal. So anyway, let's go to the Substack he wrote. This is now going back to July 24th. So I guess this is over a week ago. So he says that he can no longer be SBC. What happened? We were hit by a storm, a tornado. It's just circumstances, guys. We had no idea the tornado was coming. And for the longest time, we told ourselves it cannot be. But in much suffering, we have discovered that the Lord himself sent this tornado. Okay, this is so dramatic. this is so dramatic. The first pillar started to crack years ago when a group of Southern Baptists stood before the SBC asking for the inclusion of the Nicene Creed in the Baptist faith and message, and it didn't happen. So that's a weird thing to me. He says that the committee officially rejected the creed. No, it's more like they just didn't choose to include it. It wasn't a rejection of the Nicene Creed as the, you know, theologically, it was just a rejection of incorporating into the Baptist faith and message. And how long ago was that? I mean, this has been brewing then for a while. That was years ago. He said, I will, of course, pray that the SBC changes its mind. Actually, let's see how long that was. I'm curious about this. Oh, wait a minute. That was from the last convention? No way. I did not think that was... Wait a minute. This changes everything. I thought this was years ago. He said, a year ago. Oh, wait, this changes everything, guys. It started a year ago. Think about this. I made a major denominational shift as a professor at a theological seminary. It all started a year ago. What's wrong with that sentence? That's kind of scary. It's scary that people would just accept that too and be like, oh yeah, just keep teaching theology. I mean, that's not really a reason, in my opinion. That's, you've been in a Southern Baptist convention your whole life. It never included the Nicene Creed. And so all of a sudden you're going to include the Nicene. This is just weird. I don't believe that's the reason. I'm just going to be honest with you. I will, of course, pray that the SBC changes its mind. Okay. The second pillar that started to crack was polity. Okay, so this is actual substantive reason. More specifically, the culture in which it is embedded. My experience after two decades, both at the local level and the institutional level, is for the Southern Baptist, image is everything. Well, no kidding, dude. That's what I've been talking about for years. No kidding. There is nothing and no one they will not sacrifice on the altar of their image. No kidding. Yeah, you're just, you know, preaching to the choir here. But it's not just a commitment. It's embedded in the culture itself. When image is everything, a culture of fear follows, so that anyone who does not match up with that image is considered a threat, blah, blah, blah. Okay. This is what I'm going to say about this. He's getting to the more substantive polity difference, because, you know, obviously there's a heavier hand Anglicans have, and they have a stronger polity. It's not an independent thing. There's oversight. So he develops a conviction, but if you notice the order, it seems to me it starts with recognizing a problem. So and that's often how things start, right? So you recognize a problem. Now, is the problem with the Southern Baptist? This is my take on this. Is it that the Southern Baptist theology, okay? Theology. So separate theology from the politics of the convention. The theology, does it support this image-driven, the autonomy of the local church specifically, does that constitute a support for an image-driven kind of packaging and gossip and backbiting and, you know, all the things he complains about? No, it doesn't, actually. In fact, it has shielded, I think, churches from following some of the decisions because they're not binding, because they still have their independence. It's actually a strength of the Southern Baptist Convention in one way, because they have so many conservative people in the lower ranks. Now, here's the thing. If you didn't have conservative people in the lower ranks, let's say you were the PCUSA or the, Northern Baptists who are now American Baptists who have gone more liberal. Like, once you lose that, then it's a different scenario. And actually, it would be much better to have a heavy hand, because if the people who are Orthodox are at the top of the denomination, then they can institute changes using their power, right? But how often does that happen, right? So experience, I think, especially in experience in the United States, shows us that actually the independent model is probably going to be a better way to conserve orthodoxy. And smaller churches, I mean, I don't know where he's been. Smaller Southern Baptist churches tend to be oblivious to what's going on in the convention. That's been my experience. They don't tend to care about image that much. When you get into bigger churches, when you get into SBC politics, when you get into denominational life in the entities, then yes, absolutely there's politics. That's the same thing David Platt said when he jumped ship, right? He didn't like what it was making him to be. He didn't like what he was becoming, because I don't think he ever stopped becoming what he was becoming. The spin room he talked about. That's absolutely part of the Southern Baptist climate at those levels. And it's worse than any of you know, okay? Maybe not any of you. I don't know who's listening, but it's been years now I've had conversations with people in denominational insiders, people on the executive committee, people who served as professors at seminaries, people who are trustees at seminaries, people at NAM, people at the IMB, people. It's worse than any of you know. I'm just saying it is so bad, the politics that can happen in that denomination. But I don't think it's because of a theology. I think it's because they're the largest Protestant denomination in the country. And when you have Sauron's eye on you constantly, and you hunger for a reception among the elites, you are going to do the Russell Moore thing. You are going, if you're ambitious, you're selfishly ambitious, which is a lot of people who rise to those levels, it's just managerialism, you will do the very things that Matthew Barrett's talking about. The North American Anglican Church, is there any media coverage of the North American Anglican Church? What kinds of pressures exist on them, right? So I don't see this so much as a theological thing, and certainly not a polity thing. I see this as a, I'm just telling you, this is where I'm coming down. I see this more as a scale thing and a climate thing, the climate of the convention. And I think that gets more complicated. Why is it that way? You know, I've had guys tell me, who are in the know on these things, very much so, that there's a big resentment that basically the boomer generation had of those who were just older than them, who had the greatest generation and the silent generation pulled off the conservative resurgence. But the people that come later, the Al Mohlers, the Danny Akins, now I'm blanking on names. Who's the guy at the North American Mission, Kevin Ezell, you know, these guys were more or less at the kids' table, and that, you know, that factors into even what's going on now. I don't know fully, but that's what I think. It's more probably those kinds of things. To try to make this a theological thing, I just don't think, I don't think so. I mean, one of the things, I'll just add this and then we'll move on. It is true that the Southern Baptists do have a heavy polity at the top, even though they don't officially have that. Nature just, it's just natural to have leadership. There's going to be hierarchy. So Southern Baptists, maybe you could say they're not as honest about it or something, who knows? But yes, of course, when J.D. Greer says something, even though he's not even a president of the Southern Baptist Convention anymore, it means something in the Southern Baptist Convention because he once held a position and he's got connections. So you can't really get away from that. In the North American Anglican Church, it's going to be more honest in the sense of, not that anyone's lying, but it's just, you know, I would think that those positions are very, you know, public. You know where pressure is coming from if there's going to be pressure. Okay, the third pillar was baptism. And, you know, this one's a weird thing to me, too. Like, you've been in the Southern Baptist Convention for most of your life. You're teaching theology, but really, the argument that you just couldn't account for Acts finally got to you, that Peter's stalwart promise at Pentecost. At the end of the evangelistic message, Peter calls on the crowd to repent and be baptized for the forgiveness of sins and receive the Spirit. But that's not all. Peter adds, for the promise is for you and your children. I think Peter was smart enough to know what he was doing. He knew he was echoing God's covenant promise. It's like, this is a weird thing to me. It's like, you never heard this. Really? Like, I mean, I was just a seminary student at Southern Baptist, but we obviously had to work through that. So, like, that's just weird. Like, I wouldn't trust a guy like that to do theology. If, like, I just, like, you had to wait till you were a professor for years before you actually worked through that. That's very odd. All right, so I don't know, obviously, what the main, what's really going on here. It might be more this, because he talks about the beauty of Anglicanism. I think that's probably more likely what happened. The Book of Common Prayer is meant to be experienced. Guys, I've told you about this. I love my Book of Common Prayer. I love the Anglican chants. I think some people think I'm weird for that. But hey, I think it's beautiful. I think there is something lofty. I think there is something about the character of God that is trumpeted loudly in a very lofty way when you get back to some of these more traditional liturgies and so forth. And sort of lower level evangelicalism, low church has become somewhat of a show, much of it. And, you know, if it's not a show, it's basically it's very simple. It's very plain. And, you know, Anglicans, they wear robes. It's ornate. It's, you know, there's a lot of effort put into the aesthetics of it. And the effort, if there are, is effort put into aesthetics in lower church settings, oftentimes, I'm not saying every time, but oftentimes it is for the rock show. So I think that, let's just say that that probably is contributing here. All right. So I don't really need to read any more of this, but people asked me, people really wanted me to comment on this. So I'm commenting. And then Trinity Anglican Seminary welcomes Dr. Matthew Barrett to faculty. Wow. Beginning in August of 2025. Wow, dude. Like, it was 1 year ago when it all started for you, this transition. And now you're teaching at an Anglican seminary. It does not give me confidence for the North American Anglicans. I can tell you that, but that's all I have to say about it. I just think it's unwise. It's hasty. I don't get it. All right. So this is another listener requested thing they wanted me to talk about briefly. I'm not spending a long time here, but there's a blog website, the Roys Report. Okay. I don't know if I've ever actually talked about them or mentioned them by name. Maybe I have, but someone really who is a supporter of the podcast really wanted me to point this out, and I looked into it, and it's true. So I'll just say, yeah, I'll point it out. They featured an article back in July 22nd. Chip and Joanna Gaines tried to build a big tent. Conservative Christians aren't having it. Now, I don't even know if I'll read the article. You can go read it yourself if you want. But it's basically giving you the long and the short of Christians who are for and against the Gaineses. Now, here's the thing, though. It's obvious when you read it. It is slanted toward favoring those who would be in support of the Gaines, okay? And it is written by someone named Catherine Post. And if you look up Catherine Post, she writes for all the progressive, she works, you know, like Sojourners and those kinds of outlets, the progressive Christian outlets. She is pro-LGBT. She's progressive. And so what this particular supporter wanted me to point out, and I'll just say it, because I think it's true, is that there are outlets, and this is one of them, that focus, that they give a lot of time to things like sexual abuse. If they can find a sexual abuse case or an alleged sexual abuse case, that's a focus. That's something that they, and I mean, obviously, if it is a legitimate case of that happening, that's a horrible thing. And if anyone who is in any position of leadership is involved in that, that is something that needs to be exposed, etc. Right. But here's the rub. Biblical sexual ethics also sees these other perversions, including what the Gaines covered for, as evil and worthy of hell. Okay. That's just Christian theology. That's just biblical theology. And I think it is somewhat of a barometer to, if you're going to, if you want to support a source or you want to read a source that you think is going to give you a discernment or a news about corruption in evangelical church, because you're interested in that kind of thing, which I'm sure so many of the audience members here are, you probably might read Protestia. There's other things you look into that are along those lines. Outlets like this must have a different agenda on some level, because the motivation that an Orthodox Bible believing Christian has when they approach these things, and this would go into who they platform and what they platform, is going to be a defense of God's law, the whole thing, right? We don't just cherry pick and say, this sexual perversion is worthy of condemnation, but this one is not. That's a big problem. So I agree that's a problem, and I'm just throwing it out there. So that's sort of like a passing thing that I wanted to say, but this was something that someone wanted me to point out. Sydney Sweeney. All right, we're going to talk about this. It's not going to be that long. I know that this is, I didn't even want to really talk about this, but this is huge. Apparently it's lighting up all kinds of podcasts out there. And I really only have one point to make, because I noticed today, I actually defriended someone on Facebook over this. I noticed today there was someone on Facebook who has a lot of those same mutual friends and stuff. And they were posting these pictures, these provocative pictures of Sydney Sweeney, and then other pictures of provocative pictures of girls in jeans. And then just saying, you know, talking about how great their jeans are. Ha ha ha, double entendre. It's that because they're, I guess they're white and they're beautiful looking or something, but it's provocative. And that's not a direction we want to go, guys. This jeans commercial was obviously not in keeping with Christian ethics. I understand the human body is beautiful. The form of the human body can be beautiful. And when you abuse your body, it's not beautiful anymore. There are objective things when you start studying beauty. You know, maybe start with like Roger Scruton, right? I love Roger Scruton. Why Beauty Matters was one of his documentaries that I watched a few times. There are objective things like symmetry, for example, that the human eye finds attractive or beautiful or pleasing or healthy. There are things that sometimes you can sense it, but you don't even know how to articulate it. That's just true, right? God designed things that way. So taking a beautiful actress and advertising your product by linking it to, you could look like this person, that's obviously going to work in sales. That's what advertisers have been doing forever, except a very little anomaly over the past 10 years where all of a sudden some clothing companies decided, you know what would be good to show that we're inclusive? Let's just try to find people who are not beautiful and call them beautiful. And we'll twist everything up, right? We'll even find people who are, let's say, male, but they think they're female, and we'll make them our model for female, for feminine clothing, right? This is an anomaly. This doesn't make sense. It's I don't even know how you make that kind of thing last. You obviously have to be selling to a very warped crowd who has not just desensitized themselves, but twisted their own sense of what beauty is into something ugly. And that's what evil does, right? So, you know, kudos for, I guess, recognizing, hey, that was dumb. Let's knock it off. American Eagle figured out maybe we should put healthy looking people in our advertisements. I guess you could call that sort of a win, right? In contrast to the crazy warped sense of thinking that someone who's grossly obese is going to be beautiful, right? And I mean, I could even get in trouble for saying that on a podcast, or I could a few years ago. I don't know, you know, what would happen now, but it's like, that's an obvious thing. Like, you could have beautiful people who are grossly obese in certain ways. They're, you know, their faces might shine and they might have a nice smile. That's very true, actually. There could be features. They could have nice hair, right? Or that kind of thing. But obviously that feature itself is not something that is by the majority considered beautiful, nor has it really ever been that way in human history. And so a little pudgy, yes, because it shows you that you have wealth and you can survive a famine, I guess. I mean, that's what the Darwinists say, right? It's all survival. But I think it shows well. Some of the old paintings are like that, but they never go grossly obese. So, you know, kudos for American Eagle for figuring that out. But what do they do? Let's just be a scan. Let's be provocative. Let's be sexual about this. And then they add in the line, and I'm not showing you any of this for obvious reasons. But at the end, because I didn't even see the whole ad. I just kind of like saw the beginning and I skipped to the end. The end of the ad is them saying that Sydney Sweeney has good genes, essentially. And that was taken by some, not all, by the way. It's important to realize that. Not all, like the LA Times this morning, so I was reading one of their pieces on this. They didn't think that it was Nazi dog whistles, but there were enough liberals who said this is a Nazi dog whistle because it's a double entendre with jeans. And you're saying that because she has blue eyes and blonde or dirty blonde hair, that you're saying that people with good genes have these features. I don't think there's any reason to take it that way, to be quite honest with you. I know there's even guys who I respect on X who are saying, hey, you know, American Eagle finally figured out how to market to the young based kind of race realist crowd among whites. I could stand corrected if something comes out from their marketing team that says that, but I don't think that was it. I really don't. I think it was just a recognition that beauty actually does exist. And they could have had someone who wasn't white in the same thing and said the same. It's just, it's literally just, it's a very broad statement saying, and it probably was a joke, that someone who's got, who looks nice, who's good stock. That's what they used to say in the, back in the old days, right? Someone from good stock, pointing out the fact that this beautiful person is wearing our product and likes our product. That's it. There's really nothing else to it. This is no different than the ads that would be at the mall up until, 2013 or so. So I don't think this is like a big, big thing, but it's become a big, big thing. And, Ted Cruz has weighed in and J.D. Vance has weighed in, and it's become this political thing. And I'm just looking at it and I'm like, well, I don't, let's take beauty and let's platform that, or let's recognize that, but let's not sexualize it. That's also a twisting. Okay. When you let the whole world in on things that are meant for the context of a covenantal relationship in a marriage. Okay. I have a lot more to talk about, but I feel like I've had a number of comments, so I'm just going to get to some comments real quick. Brianna Hill says, so she's a white girl who said she has good genes. And that means no one with a different makeup can also have good genes. Alrighty then. I mean, exactly. That's my point. Why is that unique to her type or something, right? Are the blue jeans even that good? No one is asking that. Right? Right? No one cares. Right? And I'm a jeans guy, like, especially in the fall. Like, in the summer, I can't because it's so hot. But in the fall, in the winter, and in the spring, I am total jeans guy. That's what I like to wear. I mean, jean shirts, jean jacket, it's the Western kind of thing. And I tend to have a Western flair to the way I dress. Always have. So I don't buy from American Eagle, though. I go to, like, Boot Barn or, is it Sheplers online and those kinds of places. But they did not pay me to say that, by the way. But I think I have pretty good genes, just saying. Well, all that has exposed the depravity of man, says Breon Hill, which was there the whole time. Republican or Democrat, it doesn't matter. When it comes to depravity, without Christ, we stand condemned. Yep, that's what I think. I'll try to get to some other comments here in the chat. See, if you put a question mark, it's going to be easier for me to find it, by the way. Scott, a former Southern Baptist, now Presbyterian, says, John, what happened to me while at SCBTS? I wrestled with this for 2 years. I understand Barrett on that point. The infant baptism point. Here's the thing, Scott. I think that's appropriate, actually. You wrestled with it, right? You even say for years. And you're a student. You were learning these things. You weren't for years teaching at a Bible school and then adopting these beliefs instantly and then making a transition to another school. That's the difference. I understand. I think in basic terms, I get the arguments for both sides. All right, let's see. Oh, Von Bry off go hard. For $1.99 says, it's a beautiful day here in Northern Indiana, John. Well, thank you for the $1.99 there. I appreciate it. And I hope you enjoy your beautiful day in Indiana. David Laity says, if Miles Mullins is the next head of the RLC or any other Democrat leftist socialist, then that guarantees SBC won't be getting 1 cent of my money. All right. Well, we're going to keep going here because we have so much more to talk about. And we're almost an hour in. What I started talking about at the beginning. Man, this website has a lot of ads. The Daily Mail, exclusive leader of Whites Only Enclave, Eric Orwell, starred in series of live stream porn videos with his wife for cash. Okay. All right. So I don't even know if I want to read the whole story. Just if you followed this at all, which I saw an advertisement for it. And I'll be honest with you. The first thing I thought when I saw this advertisement for a community where let me get do we have the exact language of how he advertised it? I'm trying to look for an exact quote because I don't want to misrepresent it in my own words. Maybe I'm just going to have to summarize. Okay, so it's a community in outside of Little Rock, Arkansas. Actually, it's way more than outside. It's in the country. It's in Ravenden, Arkansas, and it's not even that big. It's 140 miles north of Arkansas's state capital. I don't remember how many. They didn't have like a lot of acreage, but they were building houses, and it was one of these like whites only. We don't want Jews. We don't want LGBT. We don't want anyone else. It's got to be European. And then of course the obvious, like, why are you saying we couldn't do this? Why is that controversial? Can't, you know, blacks can have their space and Jews can have their space. Why can't we have our space? I don't get it. Right. And so, oh, here's a tweet. Okay. He goes, Jews on Reddit found out about Return to the Land. That's the name of it. And now they're all riled up against this. God forbid a single explicitly white community should exist. This is a losing battle for them. If they decide to press it, they get a state and nukes, but we can't have a neighborhood. They get a state and nukes. It's I'm sorry. because Israel exists. They have a country that they can live in. We don't have anything. It's not like there's a place called Europe or Australia, New Zealand, America, Canada. But John, those places are all being taken from the populations that exist there. Right. They are, because of very stupid policies, which on this podcast, in the Christian world, at least, we have tried to oppose at every turn because they're extremely foolish, mostly immigration policies. But also the over-sexualization and all that kind of stuff, that makes a big impact. The depravity of people when they live for themselves and they don't see their role as passing on something to the next generation. The raising kids is no longer part of what's attractive to people. Well, that also is going to make a major impact on your population too. The way you raise kids and what they grow up to be, and you know, whether or not they're productive and whether or not you need foreigners who will do jobs to in certain industries. I never have actually bought the argument you actually need. I've always thought, well, the prices are going to go up for everything until it matches a point when people will actually do it. But I can't really argue against the fact that my own eyes have seen over the course of years that, yes, there does seem to be a major lazy streak. And the kinds of jobs that go to foreign workforces who come here aren't the kinds of jobs that many Americans, at least in suburban environments, seem very interested in doing, who normally would have done those jobs, you know, teenagers and so forth. So all of these things factor in. All of these things are part of the moral decay. I don't attribute this. I don't think this is all determined based on genetics. I think that, you know, otherwise you'd have to think, well, I guess white people in general must be really dumb and their countries are doing terrible things. So that means maybe, you know, especially if you're Darwinist, maybe they just need to go. Maybe they just need to lose all these battles, right? Maybe their countries shouldn't continue to exist, the countries they've established, because they're just weak or something, right? That's obviously an argument out there. What was I saying? So this community exists for whites only, to create kind of like a safe space. Now here's why I was kind of like laughing though, because you look at a map of this and you're like, okay, it's for anyone who's well-traveled, right? Ravenden, Arkansas. Here's the question. If you really want to live among descendants of Europeans, okay, there are a number of places you can go in this country and you can actually do that. One of them would probably be Ravenden, Arkansas, or any of the surrounding areas. That's the thing. Anyone ever driven through Arkansas, right? Outside of an urban area, into a rural area. I mean, yeah, you pretty much are going to be in a community that fits that description. So you'd almost have to have like an apocalyptic kind of like scenario in your head, I suppose, for thinking that like you're not going to be able to have that kind of a community anywhere. There's a lot of places in the United States you can have that kind of a community. I think it's a little different for places like South Africa, South Africa is the only one I'm really thinking. That's the first one I'm thinking of, at least, where you'd have a little bit of a different history, but there's a massive crime problem, and that crime problem extends to these rural areas. And so you need these big gated communities. And there are communities there that vet. I don't know. I think there's more than one, but I know there's one that's famous because they basically limit it to white people. Now, in South Africa, that means you're basically talking about Boers, and you're talking about the descendants of British people, or those who have intermarried between the Boers and the British. In America, when you talk about white, what are you talking about? That's another question that you have. There's a different scaling. So it's a different set of circumstances. You're talking about Italians and Irish and different waves of Irish immigration. You're talking about Germans and Scandinavians and Swiss and people in the Midwest who have gone there. You're talking about maybe even Russians and Finnish people in California. It's kind of a broad category. And I'm here to tell you, just having traveled a lot and lived in different places and so forth, there's a lot of differences. Just there's a lot of differences. Even just north-south basic differences are, there's a lot of resentment in southern areas for northerners who are coming down, who are white, who are, you know, descendants of Europeans, and they have completely different views about how, what society should look like. They want it to look like the Northeast, where they've have their little socialism going on, and southern areas hate that. So it's a very broad kind of thing. It's not very particular, right? And so when I saw it, I was like, this has to be like, he was, the interview I saw was with this guy was just, he was just saying like edgy stuff to say it. Right. And I get it, sort of like it's an engagement farming thing, probably. Like if I say edgy things, I get more negative media coverage, but that translates into positive media coverage for people interested in this kind of thing. But it's got a pioneer feel to it, right? Like you're going to be part of like the ground, you're returning to the land. So it's got sort of this naturalistic sort of bent, but what the product he's offering though, I don't think is like, so the words he's saying is it's for whites, but I think the product he's offering isn't so much that, because you can get that in the surrounding area. The product he's actually offering is he's offering significance. He's offering the grass is greener on the other side. And this is someone who's a showman, I think. That was my take just after watching one video, that he can sell this as you're part of something really big. You're part of like even comparing it to the state of Israel, right? Like, man, the Jews have a state, it's Israel. Like you're part of something like that here. Like it makes you think you're on the cutting edge of history. It's like, and you know, the scenes are all like building houses in the wilderness. I mean, that's really, that's kind of a cool thing, especially for guys who want to go out there. I'm not lying. You know, I'm not going to deny that. That's, you know, let's build a log cabin in the middle of nowhere. Right. And be with our buddies and that kind of thing. But I think that's what it is. It's a very small club. This isn't going to appeal to the majority of people. And it probably is going to cause friction with neighbors and so forth who are also white. Now, how is that natural question? And so this is what, one of the things that got me thinking about it. This guy, Phil Williams, keeps doing hit pieces. Reporter or journalist in Nashville keeps doing these hit pieces on the Ridge Runner community. But it's not even a Ridge Runner community. It's literally just a Ridge Runner is a company that buys land and then sells it. And the appeal is for people who are very, on a very broad level, seeking to escape blue states mostly and live in a place that's going to respect their civil liberties and a culture that will hopefully reinforce Christian values and those kinds of things. That is something that actually is in demand, much more so. And it's not a, it's not like a commune or anything like that. It's more organic, right? There's not like one church people are going to. There's not any centralized. The only centralized thing is that you have a company that's interested in providing a way that mostly people who would be, you know, not commuters, but what do you call it? When you work from your computer, you know, people who are working from their computer and they're mobile like that. They can go and they can live at a place that is already naturally conservative and just integrate into the community. That's basically the idea behind it. It's actually a very different idea than this. This is more cloistered. This is more, let's play up the edginess. Let's make this about, you know, you got the pioneer spirit and you're building something that's grandiose. And it's giving significance. Ridge Runner is different because Ridge Runner is just basically a real estate company that is offering a product that people are after because they want to be normal and have kids and raise them in an environment that generally is going to reinforce the values they share. So that's my separation, but I see people online trying to couple these things together. And I'm just like, no, one's grifty. One's a grift. One's a guy who knows how to be a salesman. And now it's come out. Yes, he was acting. Yeah, no LGBT people allowed. We're going to have high integrity and morals here. Meanwhile, the dude's been at, like, in the recent past has been acting in pornographic films with his ex-wife that he's divorced. And so totally different look. He's obviously changed his entire demeanor and what he looks like, including dyeing his hair, apparently, to fit a certain persona to try to sell this. I mean, that's what's going on. That's much different than, hey, let's leave our blue state to go to a red state where they support our gun rights, right? Little different, guys, just a little different. All right. I don't know if laptop jobs, says Stephen Smith. That wasn't the thing, but that'll work. Telecommuters, I think that's what I was thinking. Telecommuters, but that's kind of an old word now because you don't use a telephone, do you? John, didn't you have a man in your cast years ago that started a community on a river in Kentucky, I think? Actually, that's what I was just talking about, was Ridge Runner. It's Kentucky and Tennessee, and it's more of an integration into communities that are already there. It's just buying land that's happens to be a better price than the kind of land you're going to get in the suburban and blue areas. And then you get to move there and be in an environment that already exists where you can raise your children. And this was started at a time when people were obviously doing this a lot more because of COVID and all that. They were looking for places. And yes, I think Ridge Runner saw an opportunity there. Like, oh, you know, we could get in on this and we could also provide a very, a natural fit for people who are looking for that kind of a life. But I would even caution people in that. If you got to be ready for what you're going to expect. The grass is always greener. There's no utopia. You will carry a lot of the same problems you think you have where you live. You're going to carry them wherever you go. And you might think this is great. I'm going to have all these friends. You may, but give it time. People are people. You're going to have church fractures. You're going to have fallouts with people. This is just the human condition. So don't expect you get away from the human condition by moving anywhere. You won't. And that's why communes generally, and the tighter they are, usually the worse, they tend to fall apart. Unless you have a very, what's the scale at which they work? The family, right? So if you have a scale where it's like people all except one authority, it's like dad, he's the patriarch, right? Then it seems to work. But it doesn't work when the scales get too big, and it just doesn't. That's human history. I live in New York, right? I mean, the Oneonta community was here. All sorts of utopian schemes in the Northeast, and it's just be careful of that kind of thinking. Cause we can do that even just with moving to a new place, right? It's going to be so great. Yeah. Some things might be, you might love some things, but you're also dealing with humans and you're human. So that's a Christian understanding there. As far as confirming one's faith and making it strong against deception, the book, The Ultimate Proof of Creation by Jason Lyle, is fantastic, says Cosmic Treason, together with AIG's Answer Books and The Genesis Flood. I used to hand that one out, The Ultimate Proof of Creation. I've changed a little bit in my feeling on apologetics, but I still think that's a good book to work through. There's a lot of good points that are made in that. Okay, well, let's keep going. We are going to talk a little bit about some abortion stuff because I think this stuff actually is important. I want to remind you about something. And look, Senator James Lankford, the guy that loves the ERLC, is at the top of this, but he's applauding something Trump did that's actually good at the Department of Veterans Affairs. And that is, they are no longer allowed to perform abortions. So the administration posted the proposed rule change in the Federal Register, which will be formally published on Monday. So by Monday, abortions are prohibited. They cannot be performed by the Department of Veterans Affairs. So for all you out there who think Trump is going to be so anti-pro life or anti, or he's going to be pro-abortion and stuff. I mean, you just keep getting these stories where he's limiting it. And then I wanted to point out, where did I want to go next? Let's see here. Oh no, I can't read this. Okay. Oh, I didn't sign in on the Epoch Times. Okay. It's on my other browser. Well, I'll summarize the story. The Epoch Times reported that New York and Texas are fighting. And this is funny because, not funny, it's sad actually, but it's interesting because what official was it? It was, I think, the county commissioner or something, but it was an official in Ulster County, which is the county that I live in New York, that this particular official is resisting a lawsuit from Texas, and it's all over a doctor, apparently in this county, mailing abortifacients pills to someone in Texas. And in New York, there's a law that the governor signed that you cannot limit access to these kinds of things. Texas has a law that's the exact opposite. So now you have a clash that will probably be decided in a federal court. But that's the situation we live in post Roe, is these states are now grinding gears against each other. So I am thankful in the White House, there's at least someone who is going to, it sounds like, listen more often than not to his constituency. And, you know, we'll see what happens with it, but you can pray for that situation. These are actual tangible situations we can pray for. I was also going to mention this. I actually know this man, not like deeply, but years ago, you know, I've met him a few times, and his name is Jason McGuire, and pray for him. New Yorkers Families Foundation. This is probably the one organization in New York State that does lobbying on behalf of Christians, evangelical Christians, at the state capitol. Very liberal state, but they actually do effective lobbying. And Jason McGuire is the president, and he has been sentenced to 8 weekends in the Livingston County Jail following a guilty plea by 2 misdemeanors earlier this year. The board of directors of New Yorker Families Foundation is outraged and grieved at the result of the recent legal proceedings involving our executive director, Jason McGuire. We believe that New York State Attorney General Letitia James and her staff abused the legal privilege. And so anyway, Jason pleaded guilty to 2 misdemeanors. He did so for the purpose of making a time-consuming, onerous, and expensive legal problem go away. Based on Jason's long tenure with our organization, his character, his integrity, we are confident that Jason did not engage in any intentional wrongdoing. We had hoped that the legal process would see Jason's case for the politically motivated. Okay, so it's a political targeting of Jason and his ministry. And I did see there was a video, it's not on this page, but there's a video of Jason explaining all of it. And he basically got probed by New York State. I mean, they're just looking for anything. And it was some very minor sort of, I don't even remember what they were. It was like, you know, supposed financial discrepancies that were extremely minor that actually were explainable, and he could have fought in court, but it was like it would take $500,000, and they are already on a shoestring budget, so he's just going to go to jail. And I don't know, it kind of breaks my heart a little bit. I mean, this is the problem in New York. If you have any kind of resistance, even though they have a leftist monopoly, you get targeted. And with the tax codes the way they are and everything, it doesn't really matter. You can find something, you can find a technicality and just put someone away, which is not the way it should be. I also wanted to highlight the fact that there are Nigerian Christians who have blocked a highway to protest the government inaction after 200 Christians killed in a massacre. This just happened. This is the massacre itself was June 1st. And I mean, this just keeps happening in Nigeria. This is why I really recommend following Equipping the Persecuted. That's the name of it. Not Voice of the Martyrs. No, Equipping the Persecuted. It's just sad. Pray for our Nigerian brothers and sisters. They are going through things we just cannot even conceive of in our country. They are being targeted. I mean, someone just goes into the village and starts bombing and mowing down people. That's what they have to deal with because of Boko Haram, Islamic terrorism. So pray for them. And then I thought this was sort of sad. Spurgeon's College, an influential evangelical training center in London, to close after 169 years. And it says the decision by the Board of Trustees was made with a deep sadness and great regret. This is marks the end of the United Kingdom's most influential evangelical training centers. Trustees stated that ongoing financial challenges, compounded by declining student enrollment and difficult funding landscape for theological education, had left the college in a precarious position. It's just sad. It tells you about the state of Great Britain as well, where they're going. And it's, I don't know what the Lord's doing, guys. I really don't. There's a lot of hard hearts out there. There's still people that the Lord is working on. And we've even seen that at the fair. I was talking to one of the people who was working the booth previous day this week, and someone made a profession of faith right there. Convicted of sin, you know, but the vast majority of people you talk to, they're not interested. And I'm in the Northeast. It's a little different here. I recognize that, but you wonder sometimes, what is the Lord doing? What's he moving us towards? Now, I know some people look for those answers in eschatology and their specific flavor of Christian eschatology, that, you know, one world government or that kind of thing. And I think it's hard to, even if you believe that that's the ultimate destination, you don't know where the hills and valleys are. Things ebb and flow. And so in the here and now, and as you look back at history, you can see times where God's spirit moved in just massive, miraculous ways. And the Welsh revivals, obviously, being one of a recent example like that, the Great Awakening. But there's also examples of just, you know, it's slow. And, you know, I don't know why are Christians being persecuted in Nigeria, and why is Christianity, the lights are going out on Christianity in Great Britain, which was the main country that sent missionaries to the other parts of the world. It was Great Britain and then the United States. And I see the United States as very much an extension of Great Britain, as I do Australia, South Africa, New Zealand. These are all places that are part, they're all cousins, essentially. They're all part of the Anglosphere. And they have been the foremost proponents of Christian cultural values. And when Christianity goes, the values go with it. They're tied together. You don't have, you know, this is one of the problems with some of the more secular or pagan right elements, including what I would imagine to be this guy who thinks he's starting this whites only commune, or I don't know if he calls it a commune, it's community, but it's on a very, what is it? How many acres is that community? I'm actually curious now. I don't think it's that big of a plot. So it's, you know, if the scale is so small, it could end up being more of a commune. It doesn't say in the piece, but anyway, you can say all day long, we want to get back to our Christian identity. I mean, the Christian identity movement, by the way, that's something to also be on the lookout for, because there is and it's been very fringy, but I have seen guys promoting some of these ideas lately that are not as fringy. And basically, it looks at Europe and Christianity as intrinsically tied together, which they have been for quite a few centuries, but it wants to essentially reduce Christian identity to a European thing. It's a European identity. And in so doing, it's, for lack of a better term, it's like, if you're white, you're Christian because this is the religion that we have. Right. And so you need to just be true to the religion of your ancestors. Of course, there's people making the same argument for worshiping Odin, but there's Christian identitarians who are making this argument. Some the more radical sects, like the Hebrew Israelite guys, think that the white people are the actual Jews, right? Which is nuts. But this is the argument that's being made. And that you have to separate that from true Christianity. You have to be able to look and say, yes, Christianity did make an impact on these communities. And we are thankful for cultural Christianity because of those values, because we want clean streets, because we want safety for our children. But I'm not going to confuse that with authentic born again Christianity. I'm not going to confuse that with a conversion experience just because someone happens to echo some of the moral laws that Christianity teaches. See, they may be benefiting from a Christian society, and that is a great thing. We want to support it, but it doesn't mean they're Christian. And yeah, good works don't get you there, right? Obviously, this is Christianity 101. So I see this as sort of a trap, and this is going to be the peril that some of these more secular slash Christian identitarian groups want to move toward without actually having Christianity. You can't say we want our Christian enclave, but yeah, you know, I was working in pornography very recently. Like, that's obviously that those two are incongruent. You have to, the morality has to start internally. The virtue has to be internal. It has to be a conviction. Who you are in private matters, right? Those are the kinds of things. And I'm not saying perfection, I'm saying direction. You must be battling sin, right, in your private private self to then go and battle it out there. It must be something the Holy Spirit, without the Spirit's help, I just don't see the efforts lasting to try to preserve Christianity and cultural Christianity. It relies on authentic Christianity, right? You can't really have one without the other. So that's the Lord is doing something, though. The people want, there's enough people that have interest in Christianity and Christian identity. Will it make the jump, though? And that depends on, does the Lord move? So pray for that. And also, are we going to be faithful? So do we go out there and do we faithfully exemplify what it looks like to be a Christian? Do we show that to the people that we're around? And do we proclaim the gospel message so people's hearts are transformed? Because without that transformation, you're just not going to have it, guys. It's not, you don't have the restoration that we all want, the going back to heritage and all the rest. Christianity's tied to that, but it's real Christianity. And so you need real Christianity. You have to have at least enough real Christians to support that kind of society. All right. Well, a few comments and we'll end the show. John, what do you think about Israel starving Christians in Gaza? Oh, wow. That's that'd probably be enough for a whole podcast. I'm going to be honest and just say I have seen tons of stuff online. And yes, I've heard Tucker Carlson things and probably many of the things many of you are listening to. I would have to really look at the issue deeply myself to get past all the propaganda potential. And sometimes it's hard to tell what's propaganda and what is not. I tend to think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. So here's the debate on the starving thing. Or at least these are the two sides. One version is Israel is preventing these humanitarian aid from going into the Gaza Strip. Another version is Hamas is confiscating the humanitarian aid that's going into the Gaza Strip. Could both be, so your options are, right, one's true, the other's true, both are true. And it's not something I've looked into deeply. Now, how many Christians are in that region at this point? I don't think that many. But there are Christians who come from that region of the world. So how, you know, people have thrown out stats like it's 1%, it's 2%. I don't know. I'm not sure. But obviously, I don't want anyone to get hurt. I don't want anyone to die. I want the killing to stop. I want Hamas to stop. I want Israel to stop. I want the whole thing to stop. But like I've said on my previous podcasts on Middle Eastern politics, it seems like it's a problem that can only be managed, and it doesn't go away until one side wins. And if you listen to my podcast earlier this week on Christian Zionism, this problem goes right back to the formation of the state of Israel when you had so many people fleeing their homes, and then they were replaced by Jewish people fleeing surrounding Muslim nations. And the Muslim nations did not want to absorb the people who fled. I mean, you would think that would be somewhat of a simple fix. I mean, obviously the cameras will find the Palestinians who say, this is our home. We don't want to leave. We're not going to leave. At this point, you don't leave though. And you're subject to these conditions. You're in a war zone. And I'm a big advocate of, let's get these people out of there. But I really don't want it to be the refugee crisis that we saw in 2015. I would prefer, this is not Europe that takes this problem, that this is something that surrounding Muslim nations take and maybe, I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about the politics of the region to know what kind of levers are there, if there's even a lever available to influence. It doesn't seem like there is. It doesn't seem like there's a way to get, it's like all these Muslim countries are going to support in their rhetoric the people in the Gaza Strip, but they don't want to, for some reason, absorb them into their countries. I don't know what to say. Pray for the problem. especially for our Christian brothers who are there. Absolutely. I'm definitely skeptical of Israel, just so you know, too. I am not just thinking Israel, everything they do is pure as the driven snow. I think Israel does have an interest in getting people out of there and in expanding their territory. They've obviously given up territory many times, I think, because of political considerations. And there's obviously a growing group in Israel who does not want that to happen anymore. And they would prefer that Israel actually takes some of the land that they captured in 1967 and then 1973 and gave up again. So, guys, it's complicated. Man, I didn't really want to get into this, but if you guys really want me to, I'll tell you what. If you really want me to, I will talk about this issue more. There's a piece that I have coming out. My patrons have access to it, and I appreciate all your support. If you go to patreon.com/John Harris Podcast, you will have access. But hopefully it will be published by American Reformer this next week. But it's on Christian Zionism, and it's going to parallel a lot of the things I said in my podcast, but it's obviously cleaned up for a publication, and you can share it with your friends and that kind of thing. If you want me to tackle this stuff a little more, I will, but I'm not going to let, I don't want my focus to totally shift to that, which I've seen a lot of podcasters do. I'm the George Washington foreign policy guy. I want to unwind ourselves from the foreign conflicts as much as possible at a governmental level. And I'm really interested in, hey, let's get back to, people need to be educated on their actual Anglo-American conservative tradition that they've forgotten. That's one of my big missions now, and I don't want to be dissuaded from that. So I can do a little more stuff in the Middle East if people really want me to, but just between you and me, I'm going to be spending a big portion of next week preparing and then airing the Patreon exclusive on the Anti-Federalist Papers. So I see that as very important. People need to get in touch with their past. We need to go back to the roots. Okay. And that's part of it. So, I don't know if there's anything more, a few more comments and we'll go. More than 45 million states, none will take the Gazans. Why? I don't want to, I have ideas, but I don't want to get into it. Tucker has become way too emotional and way too focused on foreign affairs, which are his weak area. I will admit I have heard, I don't know if I want to even say this. I have an appreciation for Tucker Carlson. I've had an appreciation for years for his, I actually watched him when he was on MSNBC. If you could remember back that far, it was like 15, 20 years ago. And I always kind of liked his personality. He was just not afraid to ask questions, it seemed like, and hold people accountable. And I appreciate that about him. Here's the thing that I think is hard when you're a Tucker Carlson. When you are covering such a broad array of topics, and we all have a scale. We know certain things. We can't know everything. It becomes difficult. And I heard one interview he was doing, and one of his guests said something that I knew. I was like, oh, I know about that topic. And I'm like, that was false. And Tucker was just kind of nodding along. I think that's sort of the trade-off. Like, if you're going to output the amount of content from the amount of perspectives on the amount of topics he's doing, you have to look at it that way. He's providing a platform for people he considers interesting. That's all his show is basically at this point. People he considers interesting get to go and talk about what he finds interesting. You have to do the research yourself. I don't always just assume that just because they're on his show that everything they're saying is true. It may or it may not be. That's all I'll say about that. But I do appreciate Tucker. So anyone not sympathetic with our brothers and sisters in Christ and demanding they move out of their homeland in Palestine for Christ rejecting Israel is in sin. Not sympathetic. Okay. I mean, I am sympathetic. I'm not demanding they move out of their homeland either. I'm just saying, here's the thing. Like, you can look on paper and say, like, here's what right and wrong would be in this situation. And let's go back to 1948 and let's re-adjudicate all these things. The reality of politics in that region especially is it's extremely messy. And you have to, if you're going to have an avenue that makes the most sense for everyone who's a party to the conflict or a victim in the conflict, you have to be practical with the on the ground reality. The on the ground reality is this has been a war zone for a while, and it will probably continue to be a war zone. And when your home is rubble or in danger of becoming rubble, because everything around you is rubble, then what's the best solution? The best solution that I can think of, the most immediate way to try to gain relief is to, even if it's temporary, is to allow some of these people into surrounding countries where they can at least be out of harm's way. That's what I would hope for Christians in that area. So, but I guess I'm in sin. We have a very small contingent of brothers and sisters in both sides of the Holy Land conflict. That's a good point, too. We're going to end the stream because I don't want to get it sucked into this too deeply. But yes, there are Christians in Israel as well. That is very true. There's Christians on both sides of that. There's even Muslims. There's like usually between 8 to 12. I think there's 10 right now who sit on the Knesset, if you can believe it. So, I mean, Israel's population is like 73.5% Jewish. But there's a number of Muslims there. There's also Druze and Christians. And I mean, it's a secular state. That's what it is. That's why I see keep people saying it's an ethno state. I'm like, well, I mean, I guess you could say because if you're Jewish and you can immigrate there more easily. But I mean, for all intents and purposes, it is a secular state. And that's one of the main reasons Western European countries support it. But you will find all that out in my article being published next week. Hopefully by American Reformer. We'll see. If not, I'll find somewhere else. All right. God bless, guys. Hope you have a wonderful weekend, and more coming. Bye now.
Class is now in session, and the UPS store is here to help you ace arriving on campus. Our certified packing experts can pack everything you need, from desktops to decor. Plus, when you pack and ship with us, you get our exclusive pack and ship guarantee. Your items arrive safe or your money back. Restrictions and limitations apply. To get a 20% off packing coupon and for full details, visit theupsstore.com/packing.